podium for the Temple of Jupiter, though obviously on a very different scale, is the standard shape of a Roman temple podium, but I'm not sure I see that from the pics you've linked to. I attach here one of ours from the Temple of Bacchus, same angle as the one you sent. It shows a podium with a single straight side, apart from the lip at top and bottom, whereas the podium of the Temple of Jupiter gives more of a stepped effect, with the row of huge megalithic blocks that, according to our correspondence, form part of the lowest layer of the Julio-Claudian temple podium, stepped out very far from the sheer wall above them, on top of which stood the peristasis. I suppose the resemblance would be better if the megalithic layer had been completed and extended all the way up to the top of the wall, but the peristasis would still have been set back a few meters from the top, instead of pretty much flush with the top, as it is in the Temple of Bacchus. In short, when I zoom in to the Temple of Bacchus podium, I don't really see blocks, regardless of scale, that correspond with the Trilithon blocks. Am I missing something obvious here? I also ask, have you found organic materials with good provenance anywhere in podium 2, and have you done carbon dating on these? On the carbon dating, Lohmann replies that, unfortunately, none had been done. The history of constant change in the building, he says, as well as deep excavation levels of the past 100 years, have left no archaeological or organic material at all that would help us with this. In its own way, this is quite a revelation to me, since it means, to deploy an appropriate metaphor, that the entire edifice of archaeological chronology for the so-called Julio-Claudian podium, podium 2 of the Temple of Jupiter, rests on foundations in which there is no scientific dating evidence whatsoever. This is not to say that radiocarbon dates for archaeological sites are unproblematic. As we've seen in earlier chapters, they are often very problematic indeed, unless it can be demonstrated, as is the case at Göbekli Tepe, that the dated organic remains have been sealed at a particular moment and there is no possibility of subsequent intrusion of later materials that might give a falsely young date. But there are simply no carbon dates, problematic or not, for podium 2. It follows, therefore, that the orthodox chronology of this incredibly interesting and peculiar structure is based entirely on stylistic factors, that certain styles of building can be associated with specific cultures and specific periods, and that the style seen in podium 2 is entirely appropriate to the Julio-Claudian epoch of Roman construction. It's my view that the stylistic argument at Baalbek is nowhere near as clear-cut as it should be, given how much of our understanding of the site depends on it. And in response to my question about the positioning of the peristasis, in other words, of the four-sided porch or hall of columns surrounding the cella, the inner building of the temple, Lohmann admits there is a stylistic anomaly. Yes, normally the peristasis would rest on the edge of the podium, as it does at the Bacchus temple. That would be following the Roman examples. Mars Ultor at the Roman Forum was a milestone building for that. It is one of the oddities of Jupiter. On the other hand, Lohmann points out, temples do exist where the peristasis is set back in the way he envisages it would ultimately have been at Baalbek if podium 2 had ever been completed. For example, the Bel Temple in Palmyra, the Temple of Zeus in Izanoi, Turkey, and the colossal Temple of Tarsus, Turkey. In my opinion, he writes, this is due to the fact that both Bel Temple and Jupiter in Baalbek were built onto older podia, Herodian in Baalbek, Hellenistic in Palmyra, and had to find a solution how to squeeze a first-century latest-fashioned Roman podium underneath the even only slightly older temple building. Baalbek's terrace was immensely high, so the podium needed to be colossal, and in Palmyra, the peristasis was already standing, so the podium was erected at a distance. Further, Lohmann stands his ground on the issue of the shape of podium 2, which, despite its incompleteness, he sees as being quite normal. A standard podium, he writes, consists of a bottom profile, lip as you call it, the shaft or the vertical part, that's the trilithon layer in Baalbek, and a top lip layer. He attaches an architectural diagram of the podium of Hossan Niha, another Roman temple in Lebanon, to make his point. To my eye, however, it looks astonishingly unlike Podium 2 at Baalbek, and the lair in it that he wants me to compare to the Trilithon is just 1.58 metres, 5 feet 3 inches high, whereas the Trilithon, as we've seen, is 4.34 metres, 14 feet 3 inches high. As I've already noted, I think Daniel Lohmann makes a strong case, but nothing in our correspondence proves to me that the U-shaped megalithic wall that surrounds but does not support Podium 1 on which the Temple of Jupiter in fact stands is the work of the Romans. He could be right, but he could also be wrong, and in context of all the other indications from around the world of a lost civilization, I think it wise to keep an open mind on Baalbek. Finally, however, it's what I see in the quarry that convinces me of this, because we have to ask ourselves why three huge blocks in the range of 1,000 to 1,650 tons were left there at all. The conventional answer is that the Romans, having quarried these exceptionally large blocks, found that they could not move them and simply abandoned them. But that explanation makes very little sense. If the argument that the Romans were responsible for the U-shaped megalithic wall is correct, then we know that they went on to build an extensive temple complex dedicated to Jupiter using smaller blocks of stone. Surely their first source for the multiple smaller blocks they needed would have been the huge megaliths that, according to the argument of mainstream archaeology, they had discovered they could not move from the quarry. The Romans were practical people who would not allow work that they had already so painstakingly done to go to waste. Rather than opening up fresh quarry faces, wouldn't they have used those massive, already almost completely quarried, 1,000-ton-plus blocks and simply sliced them up into smaller, more movable megaliths for the construction of the rest of the temple? It's really puzzling that they didn't do so. And therefore the fact that these gigantic, almost finished blocks remain in the quarry and were never sliced up into smaller blocks and used in the general construction of the Temple of Jupiter suggests to me very strongly that the Romans did not even know they were there. Just as the German Archaeological Institute, despite 100 years of excavations, didn't know until 2014 that a third massive block was there. In due course, I'm told, good new information about the dating and practicalities of the quarry megaliths may be forthcoming, but that information was not available at the time of writing. I await it with interest, but also with some doubt as to whether it will settle anything or simply raise further questions. We are a species with amnesia. The devastating comet impacts that set the Younger Dryas in train 12,800 years ago, and that caused two episodes of global flooding, one at the beginning and one at the end of the Younger Dryas, made us forget so much. The recovery of memory from the fragments that remain is logistically difficult and psychologically painful, as the complexities and decades of disputes around Baalbek show. But the messages still reach us from the deep and distant past in the words of the sages, in the deeds of the magicians, and in the mighty memorials that they left behind to awaken us at the time of the great return. Part 6. Stars. Chapter 14. The Gates of the Sun. Baalbek remains very much on my mind the next day as we drive the magnificent coastline around Unia Bay, heading 38 kilometers north to Byblos, the ancient Phoenician port that claims, with some justification, to be the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. Archaeologists have established that it was occupied as early as 8,800 BC, while Göbekli Tepe still functioned. By 5,000 BC, Byblos was a flourishing, stable settlement that has never since been without human population. By 3000 BC, when it was known as Gubla or Gebel, it had grown to become the key port and city of the ancient Canaanite coast. It was the Greeks who later called it Byblos, when it served as the center of a lucrative papyrus trade with Egypt. Bublos is the Greek word for papyrus. Likewise, the reader will recall from chapter 13 that Phoenician was the Greek name for the Canaanites, and that the Phoenicians referred to themselves as Canaanites. For simplicity's sake, I will continue to use the terms Phoenician and Canaanite interchangeably here, and continue to refer to ancient Gubla Gebel as Byblos. As we pull into Byblos with its street cafes and palms and the bright Mediterranean lapping at its beautiful crescent-shaped harbour, what's on my mind about Baalbek is a question. Why didn't the Romans choose to build the greatest and most spectacular temple in their entire empire, in Rome itself? Or failing that, if for some reason they felt compelled to build the Temple of Jupiter in Lebanon, then why didn't they build it in a prestigious and important entrepot like Byblos? And if not in Byblos, then why not in another of the renowned Phoenician ports along the same coast, such as Tyre or Sidon? Why Baalbek for the Temple of Jupiter? That's the question. But there's no easy answer, because archaeologists and historians admit that not a single shred of evidence exists to tell us who commissioned, paid for, or designed any portion of the complex. We can therefore only speculate as to their motives. It is really rather surprising when you consider the scale of the enterprise that no emperor, no general, and no architect ever claimed credit for it. But the fact is that the temple remained peculiarly absent from the annals of the Romans and of all other peoples for many centuries after it was built. Not until Macrobius, who wrote in the 5th century AD, by which time Baalbek had long been Christianized, do we even get a reference to the god who was worshipped there. It is almost as though a spell of silence was cast over the place by the magicians of a former age, and that the Romans fell under its glamour, allowing themselves to be bound by it, even as they raised up the huge columns and pediments of their own temples. In consequence, as architectural historian Del Upton observes, ancient Baalbek is a figment of our imaginations. Even the site itself, as we see it now, is in a sense a work of fantasy, since so much of it, as Upton points out, was reconstructed by a German archaeological mission in the early 20th century and by French and Lebanese archaeologists in the 1930s, 1950s, and 1960s. The rest we know from reconstruction drawings of the complex in a mythical state of completion. It is a continuation of this archaeological myth-making, I believe, that leads Daniel Lohmann to his paradoxical speculation that the builders of Roman Baalbek were megalomaniacs, even though they were, in fact, so self-effacing that they never sought to associate themselves by name with any of the giant strides towards monumentality that they took there. The most gigantic of all these megalomaniac strides, of course, if Lohmann is right, was the unfinished attempt to give the Temple of Jupiter a purely cosmetic, non-load-bearing podium, rising, had it ever been completed, to around 50 feet high, dwarfing any other Roman temple podium, and made up of blocks weighing hundreds of tons, and in the case of the Trilithon, close to 1,000 tons. In Lohmann's reference frame, and the reference frame of every archaeologist for the past century, only megalomaniacs would contemplate such a task. Since we're all speculating, however, I offer the alternative speculation that the Romans chose Baalbek for the Temple of Jupiter, that it was such a special place to them, precisely because the U-shaped wall that Lohmann thinks was the base of their megalomaniac podium was already there, coming down from the time of the gods themselves, and worthy of veneration in later ages, purely in order to honor those ancient gods, rather than to exalt the names and stoke the egos of those who honored them. Star worshippers. Overlooking the ruins of Phoenician and Roman temples, a castle from the Crusader period, 12th century AD, is the dominant landmark in Byblos today. And interestingly, this Crusader castle, reconstructed and repaired many times, has at least a dozen Roman column drums reused as masonry blocks in its walls. A reminder that in this region, you can never take any piece of architecture entirely at face value. But the castle is a wonderful spot to get a sense of the old, indeed the truly ancient city of Byblos, from which Phoenician seafarers once sailed out to all points of the known world and beyond. For the suggestion that the Phoenicians reached the Americas thousands of years before Columbus continues to be supported by intriguing, though fragmentary, evidence. There is also a mysterious connection with ancient Egypt that goes far beyond the papyrus trade between these two ancient peoples. This connection concerns the god Osiris, whose celestial image the ancient Egyptians saw in the constellation of Orion. The father of Horus and the husband of Isis, the goddess of magic, Osiris was, according to tradition, a great king of primordial times, who offered the gifts of civilization to those who were willing to receive them. After weaning the indigenous peoples of Egypt from their miserable and barbarous manners, he taught them how to till the earth and how to sow and reap crops. He formulated a code of laws for them and made them worship the gods and perform service to them. He then left Egypt and traveled over the rest of the world, teaching the various nations to do what his own subjects were doing. He forced no man to carry out his instructions, but by means of gentle persuasion and an appeal to their reason, he succeeded in inducing them to practice what he preached. The deeds of this great civilizing teacher, as they are recorded in the ancient Egyptian annals, are, of course, reminiscent of the mission of those companies of gods, magicians, and sages whom the Edfu building texts tell us wandered the earth in their great ships after the flood that destroyed their homeland, seeking to bring about the resurrection of the antediluvian world. And the antagonist Set, who appears in the Edfu tradition and is eventually defeated and subdued by Horus, also plays a key role in the Osiris cycle of myths. He plots against the god-king while he's away on his civilizing mission, and on his return, he contrives to murder him with the help, significantly, of 72 co-conspirators. There is code here, for as the reader will recall, the number 72 is the heartbeat of the precessional cycle, the number of years required for 1 degree of precessional motion. The body of Osiris, we are told, is placed in a sarcophagus by Set and the other conspirators and thrown in the Nile, whence the current carries it north and out into the Mediterranean Sea. The waves carried the box to the coast of Lebanon and cast it up at Byblos, and as soon as it rested on the ground, a large tree sprang up, and growing all around the box, enclosed it on every side. The king of Byblos marveled at the size of this tree, and had it cut down and caused a pillar for his palace to be made of that portion of the trunk which contained the box. Discovering the whereabouts of her husband's remains, Isis takes ship to Byblos, goes to the palace, and contrives to have herself appointed as nursemaid to the children of the king. When unobserved, she transforms into a swallow and flies round and round the pillar lamenting. Eventually, she reveals her true identity and persuades the monarch to give her the pillar, from which she removes the sarcophagus containing the dead body of Osiris and returns with it to Egypt. What happens next is a long story that we needn't go into here, but the upshot is the resurrection of Osiris in the heavens as the constellation of Orion, where, as a star god, he reigns over the afterlife kingdom, his consort Isis by his side, in the form of the bright star Sirius, called Soptu or Sept in the ancient Egyptian language, often rendered in Greek as Sothis. In one text, which makes these stellar identifications particularly clear, Isis speaks of Osiris as follows: "Thy sacred image, Orion in heaven, rises and sets every day. I am Sothis, following after him, and I will not forsake him." And in the pyramid texts, we read, among many similar utterances, that Osiris has come as Orion. Multiple other references also identify deceased pharaohs of Egypt with Osiris and with the stars of Orion and Sirius. For example, "O flesh of the king, do not decay. You shall reach the sky as Orion. Your soul shall be as effective as Sothis." Likewise, "O king, the sky conceives you with Orion. The dawn light bears you with Orion. He who lives, lives by the command of the gods, and you live. You will regularly ascend with Orion from the eastern region of the sky. You will regularly descend with Orion into the western region of the sky." From such texts, notes Egyptologist Salim Hassan, "I think it cannot possibly be denied that at one period in their history, the Egyptians believed that the souls of their kings either mingled with the stars or became a star, and this tradition never entirely died out. Moreover, the association of the Giza pyramids with the stellar cult was long maintained by tradition, and those of Khufu and Ka